to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome again to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, anti-electoralist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like, while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. Don't forget, you are listening to River West Radio, WXRW LP, 104.1 FM. And we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization that works specifically for advocacy, education, and lifting marginalized voices in and around Milwaukee. If you'd like to support our mission, you can do so by visiting us at 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and purchasing any number of the goods that we have available and then using those goods. Or even better yet, you can become an official underwriter. Reach out if you are an entity of some kind, if you're a person who represents an entity of some kind who would like to support River West Radio and help lift marginalized voices in your community and just, you know, make possible the really great programming that is represented here on River West Radio. So I've never been a very sporty person. I was bullied pretty mercilessly in grade school. Probably because I was an easy target. I was skinny and weak. I was just terrible at sports. And I had no interest in improving at sports either. I've never really liked the ferocious competitive atmosphere and, you know, the kind of gross competitive characteristics that sports seem to bring out in people. Like whenever I'm in a room, you know, or a bar or something full of guys who love watching sports and participating in the culture of sports, they never seem happy. They always seem anxious and angry and miserable. But maybe that's just my take on it as someone looking in from the outside. But anyway, no, I was never very sporty. But some of my friends really were. And, you know, they loved to follow baseball and basketball. And they even went so far as to collect baseball cards and basketball cards with their favorite players on them. You know, they were always on the lookout for so-and-so's rookie card or something. You know, I don't get it. But I'm certainly not one to yuck their yum, so to speak. So when I was a kid growing up in Sherman Park, a buddy of mine and I would rock around the neighborhood. He lived across the street from me. And so, you know, as is often the case with kids in grade school, his and mine was probably a friendship of convenience. But we'd bum around together. And back in Sherman Park, this is before gang activity got high enough to the point where us kids weren't allowed out of the house for any stretch of time after a certain hour. So, me and my buddy, we were probably 11-ish, I would guess. We'd be allowed to walk down the block to the comic book store and the corner grocery and stuff like that. You know, and in the comic book shop, we'd try to read the adult comics, you know, that had nudity in them, and we'd inevitably get kicked out. So we, you know, we're just two kids walking around our neighborhood. Now, because my buddy collected baseball cards, he was a real sporty guy. Whenever we saw a cop car parked on the side of the road, we'd happily run up to it. And he'd ask the officers in the car if they had any packs on them. So that's really what cops were to us then. They were opportunities for baseball cards and maybe gum, I think. Because every cop carried baseball cards back then, you know, just in case kids ran up and asked for them. And we'd get one pack each, and I'd give mine to my friend because I didn't care. And then we'd be on our merry way. So that was what the police represented to me in my youth. So fast forward only a few years to when I was a teenager. I never paid attention to the news. I never cared. But something must have happened. And I couldn't even tell you what. Something must have happened because one day my mother sits down at the kitchen table with me and she asked if I talked to police ever. And I hadn't, obviously, in years, you know, since I stopped hanging out very much with that old friend because we went to different high schools. And I remember she wore a grave face and she told me in no uncertain terms to never speak to police. She said something like, they don't have my best intentions in heart, and they aren't to be trusted. She said one of my rights, for example, is to never speak to police, and that I never have to answer their questions, and to always ask for an attorney. And I remember being like shocked and like confused. And, you know, I was like, I mean, cops are the good guys, right? And I was bewildered. And I think I said something like, you know, Mom, I'm not a drug dealer or something to that effect. To which she said something about like mistaken identity and that the cops really only look for the simplest, fastest solution to any problem, whether or not it's actually correct. So it's at this point I feel I should really stress that that was a middle-class white mother telling her nerdy, harmless, middle-class white son to never trust the police. And I don't think that I really let it sink in that day. But to be sure, that conversation and her continual reminders that the police are not some force of good and righteousness in this world, it must have really stuck with me because after all, I'm an anarchist now. Sorry, Mom. So in today's episode, we're going to look briefly into the history of the modern American police force. The purpose that it truly serves in this neoliberal capitalism and some alternatives we could adopt if we wanted an actually safer, more peaceful world. So today's episode will be titled ACAB, ACAB. I'll also be peppering it with some quotes that I really love about the police and state violence and coercion and all of that. So the first such quote comes to us from Emma Goldman. And she had, in this circumstance, she'd just been framed for conspiracy to commit murder against some, politician or something like that. And she had nothing to do. And there was no actual conspiracy. It was just another example of, the government trying to frame anarchists. But anyway, upon her arrest, she was quoted as saying, "I feel sure that the police are helping us more than I could do in 10 years. They are making more anarchists than the most prominent people connected with the anarchist cause could make in 10 years. If they will only continue, I shall be very grateful. They will save me lots of work." Let's take a brief look at the history of the police as they exist today here in America. And a lot of you probably already know this, but I feel it does bear repeating to give at least some context for why the organization is truly an inherently racist, classist tool of the capitalist elite. So let's go back in time. The year is 1704, if I can paint a picture for you, and the place is specifically South Carolina. So this is pretty early days, right? You know, we're talking 13 colonies days. So the property of rich white landowners in South Carolina is being threatened. Of course, the only way to be a landowner at the time was to be a rich white man, but that goes without saying. So their property is being threatened. Thus, guards and patrols of less rich but no less white men are being formed to protect that property. What property is it? Well, it's human beings, of course. It's slaves. How is that property being threatened? Well, slaves are gathering, and they're talking about how they don't particularly want to be slaves anymore, or they're running away, or they're being defiant to their owners, and we certainly can't have that, you know, or they're being rude in public, or they're milling about. So, what must be done? Well, 1704, they formed slave patrols, which are basically groups of white men whose whole job is to sniff out runaways, break up any resistance that they might find, and essentially police the slave population. Now, the term police, and certainly the term officer, would not yet be applied to that job position, but that's the nascence of the American police force as strictly slave patrols. They would patrol the streets, rivers, the fields, all in search of slaves that had escaped. They would walk around the city and they would break up, you know, groups of slaves that were talking. They were really just around to make life even more difficult for slaves. Now, mind you, getting paid for being on a slave patrol was extremely rare. However, slave patrollers, or paddy rollers, as they were called by the slaves that they harassed, were exempt from taxes. So that was at least a benefit. Now you might be asking yourself, if you're not getting paid, what really is the other benefit for a group of, you know, largely unemployed white men? Why did hundreds flock to the position every single year? Well, the paddy rollers were never wealthy men. They came from very humble backgrounds. Specifically, ex-convicts and poor European migrants were prized for the roles for their eagerness to become paddy rollers. You can imagine, you know, put yourself in their position, breaking up slave meetings, rounding up runaways, and having the free reign to beat any slave who might have an opinion, had a tendency to make an ex-prisoner or a hated Irish immigrant feel better about himself. Now, this wasn't the first time poor whites would get a kick out of being able to punch down against someone more disenfranchised than them, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. But anyway, the police as an institution was born directly from a non-governmental body dedicated solely to controlling, subverting, and dominating black slaves in the public space. With the end of the Civil War, slave patrols would cease to exist. However, it should come as no surprise to anyone that the formation of hate groups like the KKK formed immediately following the Confederacy's loss of the Civil War. So that's the birth of the American police. Their sole job was to protect the property of rich white men. So let's keep going throughout the development of the police in America and see if anything changed. So very quickly after the end of the Civil War, class conflict began to bubble up in America. Very significantly, major strikes and riots broke out in Chicago in 1867, only 1 year after the war ended. And then again, riots broke out 10 years after that in 1877, and then again in 1886, and then again in 1894. Class riots were much more common back then. And very quickly, the rich elites in the large cities saw immigrant wage workers as a threat to their property. So they hired hundreds of thousands of men and armed them to impose order on working class neighborhoods. That's right. Most police forces were literally just hired goons working directly for rich people. They had power bought and granted by municipal governments to mete out punishment on the poor and working classes. And usually this punishment was just administered in the form of light to severe beatings. These privately owned and operated police were used to break up strikes, suppress rebellion, and ultimately protect and serve the interests of their bourgeois owners. And then again, you know, in concert with the military, they were used to extinguish the flames of full-out revolution on more than one occasion. So as these privately owned police forces became more municipalized and were eventually kind of subsumed into the government officially, they were continually encouraged to isolate themselves from forms of democratic control. That's why the police today much more closely resemble the military than other branches of government. They were encouraged to form their own specifically non-democratic hierarchies, systems of governments and rules for behavior. And that's one of the many reasons that today's police officers are rarely held accountable for their violent, often illegal actions, all to the benefit of the ruling class, because they get to police themselves, very much by design. And there was no better example of the happy relationship between business interests and the municipal police force to be found than in Chicago, where all those riots were taking place. So following the suppression of those self-same riots, wealthy business owners literally purchased presents for the Chicago PD in the form of rifles, artillery, Gatling guns, new municipal police buildings, and even so far as the police pension, which was all funded directly from the pockets of wealthy white benefactors. So it was during this kind of organic evolutionary formation of the police that new laws were being written in every city across America. Special laws with extremely vague names and poorly defined terms. Laws that sought to end quote-unquote vagrancy or quote-unquote disorderly conduct. And they were kept very purposely vague with one purpose in mind, to criminalize a person's very existence. So are you an unemployed, disenfranchised black man standing on a corner in rich downtown Chicago panhandling, you know, in an attempt to not starve or freeze to death? Well, don't worry, rich white people. He'll soon be carted off by the police for quote-unquote loitering. Yes, the police were quickly inventing all sorts of new terms that they could use to justify the use of force and to begin building what would eventually become today's prison industrial complex. And in fact, convict labor camps were the precursors to today's modern prison system and were really just a direct continuation of the chattel slavery, which the Civil War had removed as a means of free labor for rich white landowners. Now, of course, there have, of course, historically always been conscientious objectors within the rank and file of any police office. So we'll go back. During the height of the strikes in the mid-1880s, for example, some police famously sided with strikers who were only fighting for better working conditions. And you have to remember that at the time, wage slavery was actually considered to be as bad as chattel slavery. Even during the Civil War, Lincoln, for example, famously campaigned against wage slavery, comparing it to chattel slavery. So only 20 years after the end of the Civil War, workers in cities across the country were striking against wage slavery and the dangers of the workplace. And police officers that sympathized with the strikers were summarily fired, sending the message loud and clear to future generations that siding against property and capital would find you quickly out of a job. I really like this quote from Sam Mitrani, which explains it quite succinctly. The police were created to use violence to reconcile electoral democracy with industrial capitalism. So we've talked a little in past episodes about how democracy is inherently inconsistent with capitalism. And I mean like a true democracy is inherently inconsistent with capitalism, and how the two can never function together. The violence imposed by the police arm in defense of capital and the propertied classes is a direct symptom of that incongruence.
You get used to it. I mean, but you're always aware that, you know, you can get really seriously hurt at any time. I mean, and cops do stuff like, okay, I have a friend, I can't mention names, who one of the things the police were doing at a certain point, it was clearly a tactic because they started doing it in Egypt first, you know, systematically like groping women and, yeah. and you know, sort of sexual assault. They grab their breasts, they like expose them and things like that. And part of it was to traumatize the women, because women were key organizers. But part of it was also to try to provoke the men. You know, the idea is like, aren't you going to offend your women folk? So they'll try to get the men to do something that they could say is violent and then, you know, or put them in prison. So police started doing this, and there's one woman, like, they grabbed her breasts, and she said, what are you saying, come here, pervert? You know, and
in
like
York,
yelled.
In New York, they did
this
that.
Is in New York.
Okay. Oh, undercover. Yes.
Oh, no, they're actually uniformed cops.
Really?
There's lots of pictures of women, yeah. You know, one woman appeared on television the next day with giant handprints on her breast. So then they arrested her later for something else just to punish her for doing that, yeah. So they were doing the systematic sexual assault stuff. And one woman just, like, screamed at some cop, like, saying, like, what are you, some kind of fucking pervert? Like, you know, if somebody ordered you to like sexually assault them, it's disgusting. And the cop was so offended, they took her behind the lines and broke her wrists. I mean, they do stuff like that.
Right.
Breaking thumbs. I know a guy who's one of the key organizers who is a concert pianist. They broke his fingers and,
Did it feel scary down there? Were there scary days? Were there moments where you're just like, I don't know what's going to happen?
You always, I mean, it's an adrenaline thing, you know what I mean? On the one hand, there's this incredible feeling of freedom because you realize just how much you've never been in a crowd that was self-organized, essentially. You know, every moment you're actually operating under the threat of violence. If I walk this way, if I do this, if I do that, someone could attack me. But you never think about it. You know, and it's something about our society that you know, I used to live in Madagascar. In Madagascar, you know, in a small town, the place where I was, there basically were no police. And so far as there were police, they didn't concern themselves with, you know, open container laws. Or, you know, who can stand here, who can play music there, who can, like, drink this, eat this, sell this, and this, you know, everything we do is regulated, everything. But we don't think about it. But, like, those things that are regulated are enforced by violence. And we've learned this, you know, like, sell untaxed cigarettes, they could kill you. I mean, obviously in America, they can do it fairly easily if you're black. It's harder if you're white. But theoretically, they can, you know? I mean, the possibility exists. So we're always under threat. Some people more than others, but everybody. And you just internalize that. You never think about the fact that you're constantly being threatened with violence every moment of the day. But then...
That was the anthropologist David Graeber speaking about just some of the police violence experienced by peaceful protesters during the Occupy Wall Street movement. And he was an important part of that movement, and it was actually the term the 99% is attributed to him, even though, you know, it takes a movement to come up with something like that. So that's examples of people exercising their alleged constitutional rights to assemble peacefully, who were being sexually assaulted, groped, having wrists broken, fingers broken by police officers. And I don't think that there's any more blatant example of the police doing their job, their real job, namely to protect the property and business enterprise of wealthy elites. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee, and this is The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. And we're talking about police and how they're, well, we'll get into my thesis. In that interview, David Graeber goes on to describe the rush that he and others felt in the Occupy movement, of what it felt like to finally be free, as he put it, to self-organize without hierarchy and to recognize that people can absolutely come together without centralized leadership and handily solve real problems. And he says something to the extent that it makes you realize if so many of the lies that you've been told your whole life are demonstrably false, like people can't self-organize, successfully, what other things could be possible that you've always been told were impossible? So, we've talked a little bit about the history and we've come to present day. I'll make the simple case that the police are an unnecessary, dangerous force that daily threatens the lives and safety of 99% of the population. Anecdotally, here, I know business owners who have called on the police, for example, when they were, you know, just being personally robbed, and they were met with simple platitudes like, well, we'll never catch the guy, sorry, you know. But then turn around, and when this same person's business was robbed years later, the cops swooped in. They put a whole team on the case. You got like basically a dedicated task force. Police are tasked not with protecting you or your family. They couldn't care less. They are tasked with maintaining the status quo, and a monopoly on violence is their primary tool and tactic. Here in the last few minutes, we'll address the cynical question that I'm sure my family would ask if they heard me say that the police are unnecessary and dangerous. Well, what do we replace them with? Right? Well, it's been shown historically, empirically, in cities and communities without a dangerous police presence, where people are not atomized to the nth degree, by the lone wolf attitude of capitalism, and are actually allowed to interact and meet and know and care for their neighbors, that people do a good job of taking care of one another. First of all, the laws as they exist today serve only capitalist interests. We've harped on this for many episodes. Laws do not and cannot protect you. We said it a few episodes ago. You're 10 times as likely to kill yourself as you are to be murdered by someone else. And in that same episode, we pointed to clear facts that your fellow neighbors are not what threatens your life and freedom. Capitalism, industrialism, corporatism, and the state are the real threats. In communities where people know each other, we can take care of one another. Voluntary, rotating, randomly selected groups of community watch members could ensure that everyone has the community's best interests at heart. In a world where we are all guaranteed safety from structural violence. And for Johan Galton's measurements of what that is, I recommend you listen to our episode on structural violence at creamcitymedia.com/anti. In such a world free from structural violence, crime as we know it would essentially cease to exist. And what few antisocial elements remained, well, we'd be responsible for them. Because don't forget, as we mentioned a few episodes ago, you cannot have true freedom without personal responsibility. Thanks for tuning into The Anti on WXRW. I've been your host, NTSC, and we'll be back again next week to talk about freedom. Peace.